Thank you. I'm a little lame on my left side, so if you'll excuse me, I'm going to sit down while I do this. I haven't sat up all day for a long time. Glad to be here. My name's Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober by the grace of God, and because these steps work, this program works since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. Any of you folks over here on the right that want to move, or your left, can't see me or hear me, whatever, you're welcome to. I can see a couple of seats here. You can even sit in the pink seats if you want to. It'd be all right with me. We got to turn it over a little more. Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, we're going to talk about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You just heard how it works read. And I don't think I can improve a heck of a lot on that, but I can give you some of my experience with this. People are always asking, how does AA work? And sometimes we have a difficult time answering that. Ray V, who's a Baptist minister and a speaker in AA conferences like this, tells a couple of stories that I stole from him. And he's commented on that from time to time, I understand. But this is a story about the minister who went to visit the elderly ladies, two elderly ladies, and they invited him into their home. They were very glad to see him, very hospitable. And they said, would you like some cake? And he said, well, that'd be fine. He said, just have a seat here and we'll go fix some tea and some cake. So they scurried off, and he sat there, and he noticed there was a bowl of peanuts beside him, and he just kind of reached over and began to eat the peanuts. And by the time they came back with the cake and tea, he had eaten all the peanuts. And he was a little embarrassed by that, and he apologized. He said, I'm really sorry. I saw those peanuts, and I guess I'm a peanut freak. I just ate the whole damn thing, you know. And they said, oh, don't worry. He said, since we've lost our teeth, all we can do is suck the chocolate off of them. Now, that's just kind of the warm-up of the story I really want to tell. While he sat there eating peanuts, he looked over, and on the piano in the room was a condom in a glass of water. And he talked to the ladies for a while, but he couldn't get that out of his mind. And finally he said, I just have to ask about that glass on the piano. And one of the ladies said, oh, I'm glad you did. Said, we were in the park last year, and we found that object right there. And it was in a little wrapper. And it said, to prevent disease, place on organ. And we didn't have an organ, so we just took it out and put it on the piano. And do you know we haven't had a cold since we did that? Well, that's sort of like the mystery of Alcoholics Anonymous. We always don't know exactly how it works, but we're blessed to be here and to know that it does work. Some of us are new here. Some of us are just getting started. And those of us that have been around for a while provide a little hope for those that are coming along behind us. And that's the way the program really works. I read recently that, can you imagine a more powerful message to a person who's suffering from any disease than a person who's recovered standing in front of them telling me exactly how they recovered? And that's how our message is transmitted from one to the other, and has been. If it hadn't worked that way, we'd all still be meeting in a gatehouse in Akron, Ohio, I guess, if there was anybody there. I read another line the other day that I think is particularly apropos here. It was written by a minister. And he was talking about miracles. And he said a miracle, one kind of miracle anyway, is the replacement of an erroneous thought with the truth. And that transforms your life and your perspective of life. And I think largely what the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous do is allow you and I to find the error in our thoughts and replace them with the truth, and we see life in a totally different way. I have a story about alcoholism that came out of my youth. I was raised out in West Texas. I was born out in West Texas and was raised there until I was about 21 up in the panhandle of Texas. We have a panhandle to handle too. Y'all got one, we got one. Ours is a little bigger than yours, but that's all right. I was raised on this farm up there and had a dog, a bulldog, English bulldog, mostly English bulldog. I wouldn't vouch for his lineage exactly, but his name was Patches because he had little black spots on him, you know, and he was white with black spots on him, and he was a remarkable dog. He was a hero in our community because he had engaged in a fight with a badger. Badgers are bad news for dogs. But this badger had run across the wrong dog. The badger weighed 1 pound more than Patches. We know because it took about 2 hours of fighting him, he finally killed that badger, and we weighed them both, and he outweighed Patches by 1 pound. And everybody in the community knew about Patches and his fight with the badger, and he was a hero in the community. And he had no problems. He was well-loved. He was petted. He was fed. He was admired. Had no competition whatsoever in the barnyard. He was just, you know, king of the walk. And this particular morning, he was in the yard, minding his own business. And into our yard walked a big boar hog. Neighbor's hog. Ugly hog. Long yellow tusk, ambled into our yard. And Patches had certain characteristics. When he made decisions, he made them very firmly. And he decided to get hold of the hog. And he went sailing out there and got hold of the hog. And the hog began to squeal, and he was barking and growling. My dad came running out of the barn to see what was going on out there, and he began to go out and kick hogs and dogs and cuss. And I saw my dog was in a lot of trouble, and I went sailing into the middle of that fray. My mother saw her little kid getting in the middle of this chaos that was going on in the barnyard, and she came running out to get into the deal. Everybody in the barnyard had a problem. We all had a problem. There was a common solution. Patches turned loose of the hog. Let him go. Well, Patches didn't choose to do that, and the hog finally drug him alongside the barn, and he had to turn loose. And when he did, my dad caught him. He grabbed him up, and he was snapping and snarling, and he was angry, and he was wanting that hog. He was wanting that hog. And Dad took him over to a water hydrant. The hog had slashed him on the side of his neck with one of his tusks, and Dad sent me to the barn to get some pine tar to put on there to stop the bleeding, and we stopped the bleeding, and we ran cold water on him, and we cooled him off, and there was peace in the barnyard, and we turned Patches loose, and Patches went right back and got hold of the hog again, and it was the same deal. It was squealing and barking and kicking and cussing and mother wringing her hands and me trying to get my dog, and chaos reigned in the barnyard. And Dad caught him one more time, drug him back there, and this time we chained him. We committed him. We chained him to the water hydrant. Dad got in the pickup and removed all temptation by driving the hog away. I was given the job of being his counselor. I sat next to him and petted him and soothed him. And ask him deep and penetrating questions like, Patches, did you ever have a good day getting hold of hogs? Does your family object to your getting hold of hogs? Do they taste good? Why would you want to attack something so much bigger than you are? And you know, in about 2 hours, I had cured him. He was laying on the ground. He wasn't tugging at the chain anymore. His tongue was hanging out, you know, and he had that little smile on his face like bulldogs get when they get their tongue out. And he was looking around, and so I went to see my dad, and I said, "Dad, we can turn Patches loose. He's cured." And Dad said, "Well, I've had a little trouble with him this morning. I'm going to check him out." So Dad checked him out, and he said, yeah, I think he's okay. And so we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog, but he got him one more time. Now, some of you can identify with one of the more of the players in that. I guess I was the first hogging in West Texas. And it wasn't hogs at all. It wasn't hogs at all. Because he switched to cattle trucks just a little while later, and he just caught one of those. And we have a lot of people in this world who catch old cattle trucks. A lot of them are catching hold of hogs, but they move over to cattle trucks, and they just don't get back. And we don't have any solution whatsoever. None. To make it possible for us to catch hold of cattle trucks. We do not know how it's possible to allow us, once we become alcoholics, to drink again with any degree of safety whatsoever. We had a deal at my first AA group. And our deal was, if anybody went out and drank and found out how they could do it successfully, they had to come back and describe it, post it on the bulletin board so we could all do it if we wanted to. Nobody posted anything on the bulletin board. Lots went out. Some came back. Some never did. So we have a really difficult kind of condition that we deal with. It's complicated by the way the sufferer reacts to his own disease. Everybody knows he's got the problem except him. And he's blind to his own problem. He defends his illogical and erroneous actions. He lies about them. I lied about them. I was defiant. My deal was, if you want to talk to me about the way I drank, you better be willing to discuss the worst thing I know about you. Because we're going to get it all out on the table. And I'm not going to change one damn bit. I'm going to drink just exactly what I want to drink when I wanted to drink it. Now, there were people like my boss or bosses, when they talked to me about it, I was a little more subtle in the way I dealt with things. I rationalized. Actually, if you had a wife like I had, you might take a drink too. Now, that was when my wife was on me, I would say to her, actually, if you had a job like mine and all the pressures I have, you'd drink too. I rationalized, I justified, I hid my problem from myself as long as I could. And we see that happening all the time. Now, we lived, why did we drink? Why was alcohol good for us? I don't know why you liked it, but to me, it kind of chemically altered reality. I could have a bad day and have a few drinks and, you know, it wasn't so bad. What the hell? Let's have another drink. And another drink and another drink. And after a while, it wasn't bad at all. And then it got bad again. But by then, I was through with the first problem. But it was always back the next morning. But that's why I think, I don't know why I liked to drink as well as I did, but I just loved it. I liked to be intoxicated. I liked being irresponsible. I was responsible a lot, but then I could take little vacations from responsibility and be irresponsible, and I really liked that very much. But I hid behind my disease, and I can look back on my life today and cannot imagine why in the world I couldn't realize and see I had a problem. I drank mostly at home. And I drank in pretty good quantities toward the end. I drank at least a quart of whiskey every day. and I could get a few drinks at lunch or something like that. It kind of soothed me over. But I did most of my drinking at night, which meant that one of the main responsibilities my wife had was getting me to bed. It was really important that I rest after I'd had a quart of whiskey, and she, it was her job. It was her job to take me and put me to bed. I didn't always stay in bed. There were actually times when she put me to bed without taking me to the bathroom. And then I would get up and wander around the house and look for the bathroom. It's not always easy to find the bathroom. Have you ever noticed how much closets look like bathrooms? You can make a mistake doing that. And I smoked. I was an automatic smoker. I would swing my feet over to the side of the bed. No matter whether I was drunk or sober, my cigarettes and my lighter were always right there. I could just reach out and pick them up. And when I was searching for the bathroom, that's the first thing I did, was light up a cigarette. You could kind of see from the glow on your cigarette what was out there, you know. And it wasn't a pretty picture. I come back to the side of the bed, and sometimes I wasn't through smoking. And then you would sit on the side of the bed and smoke the rest of your cigarette. Well, sometimes you were tired. Often I was pretty tired. Drinking made me tired, I guess. And I would kind of lay back on the pillow and finish my bed. And one night, I woke up, and there was a pretty good-sized fire going on my side of the bed. And we got the fire put out. The bed was pretty well ruined by the time we got the fire put out. It's very difficult to explain that. The best explanation I've ever heard for that is just to tell them you think the damn thing was on fire when you got in there. I got up the next morning, and I needed to go to work quickly. I needed to get the hell out of the house as quick as I could. I shaved, I showered, I got out of there. And as I went out the door, I told my wife, buy any kind of bed you want. Buy any kind of bed you want. Don't worry about cost, just buy any kind of bed you want. And I went to work, and I came back to have a few drinks and relax a little bit in the evening, and there was a letter from my wife to me. She was there, but she had written me a letter. Seemed very strange to me, but I read the damn letter. And the letter said something like, Jerry, I have been talking to you about your smoking and drinking for a long time. Now, you've got to do something about your smoking and drinking. I can't go to bed at night without worrying about my life, the lives of our children, and even your life. You've got to do something about this. And I did, because I was responsible. I told you that. I quit smoking. I just quit smoking. Never crossed my mind to moderate or change the way I drank. I went to a few months before I quit drinking. I went to the doctor. My firm required me to go to have all the employees to have a physical every year. And the year before, the doctor had told me that my liver tests were not good. That he said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "How much?" And I said, "Pretty good." And he said, "Well, you really need to moderate. Some people can drink, some people can't, and you've got a bad liver problem here." So I didn't do anything about that, of course. I just drank like I always drank. And I went to the doctor and the next year, and he looked at me, and he ran the test again, and he called me, and he said, "See, I want to show you this test, this graph." He said, "Your test is off the chart. You're in serious trouble with your liver. Now you got to do something about your liver. Now what I want you to do is not drink anything at all for 10 days and return, and we'll repeat the test." Well, I left his office and had absolutely no intention whatsoever of ever going back. I wasn't going to quit drinking. Why in the hell would, if I quit drinking and went back and it was better, you know he's not going to let me drink anymore. If it was worse, have you ever heard of a doctor who had a patient that had bad liver problems, said drink a quart of whiskey a day? Hell no, they're not going to tell you that. That was a no-win situation for me. Why would I want to go back to that? Now, that's just kind of the insanity that lived in my life. That's kind of the insanity that persisted in my life until I reached a place in my life where I couldn't go on. I reached the place that they talk about, the dilemma of the alcoholic in the big book, where I had a choice. I could either go on trying to blot out my life, which was unacceptable to me, or I could try to do something about it. And I decided to try to do something about it. I decided to try to quit drinking, something I'd promised I would never do in my life, but I decided I would try to quit. And I tried 2 days. 2 days I was without alcohol. I don't know how you were when you quit drinking, but it surprised me. If you're doing something bad for yourself, you'd think when you quit, you'd start getting better. It didn't happen for me. I was unable to sleep. I don't know whether anybody else had that problem or not. I was always in the wrong place. If I was outside, I ought to be inside. If I was inside, I ought to be sitting down. If I was sitting down, I ought to be laying down. If I was laying down, I ought to be up walking around outside. And I mean, I'm just moving and grooving quick. And it's driving me crazy. I can't think about but one thing in the world, alcohol. My body, all my body was sending messages to my brain and says, we need a drink. You've forgotten something today. Get it down here right now. We need it. And so I did something else I promised I'd never do. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I reached a very unsympathetic woman on the other end of the line. I told her I was having a little problem quitting drinking, and she said, when do you drink? And I said, well, mostly in the evening. And she said, well, you need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night. And I said, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. I'm a busy, big-time lawyer, and I just wouldn't have time for that. And she said, didn't you say you'd been drinking every evening? I said, yes. And she said, well, we're going to quit that, aren't we? So you're going to have some free time. So I said, what do you got? I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't understand a thing in the world about what you were doing here. Saw your funky little signs on the wall. I didn't have a Sunday school problem. That's what you all were talking about. I had a serious problem. I wanted somebody to fix me. And the problem is, to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to recover from the alcoholic condition, you have to be involved. There are no spectators who are alcoholics who ever recover. You're a player whether you like it or not. And I had to begin to play. And it told me that my alcoholism centered in my mind. And they told me that I had to learn to think and react to life in a new way. And they told me the way I would do that is to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so very reluctantly, knowing they wouldn't work, but having no other options, I started doing what the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, the book says, suggested. They weren't suggesting these things to me. They were telling me what I needed to do. And so I began to go down this road because they were obviously alcoholics. They talked about it. I could understand it. I could identify with them. And they had changed their life. And they treated me differently than I had ever been treated in any group before. They never didn't ask me what my job was. They didn't seem to give a damn that I was a big-time lawyer. They didn't ask me whether I had a swimming pool in my backyard, what kind of car I drove, how much money I made. None of the things that were important to me were discussed. They asked me what step I was on. They asked me if I had a sponsor. They asked me all these questions, and they did things, strange things. They stood up in meetings and did some of the strangest damn things I ever saw in my life. They talked about the worst things in their life, the terrible things that they had done, things that had happened to them, and the audience would just laugh like hell every time they told one of them. The most inappropriate sense of humor that I had ever seen in my life. Well, I'd done a couple of things I thought were kind of cute, so I thought, well, hell, I might tell them. And so I told them, and they embraced me. And they said, looky here, Jerry is beginning to be himself. And that's what it's all about, to be yourself. You don't have, you can't start from anywhere except where you are right now. What time is it? Now. Where are you? Here. You don't start from being vice president of a company or being married or what. You start with what you got today. And you begin to work through that. And that's where the program takes you. You start off, it positions you exactly where you need to be with the first step. Says we were powerless over alcohol, our lives were unmanageable. Was I powerless over alcohol? My God, yes. Yes. I tried to drink 3 drinks a day for over a year and a half and never made it one day. I couldn't. When I put something in, it kept going. And then they told me about the doctor's opinion, about how the doctor had written this opinion and said that it was an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. Well, I didn't break out in hives, and I didn't have sneezing and that sort of thing when I drank. That wasn't my idea of allergy, but they said, wait a minute. Your body reacts differently to alcohol than most people. You are mentally and bodily different from your fellows. Now, I didn't particularly like to hear that, but it's the truth. It's the truth. When I drink whiskey, I take a drink and it goes down and hits the bottom. Boom. It begins to kind of warm me up. And then my body, my stomach sends a message to my brain that says, I think we'll have another one of those. And another one, and another one, and another one until I've had too many. And then I sober up, and the obsession of the mind kicks in. Do you know what an obsession is? An obsession is a great big thought. It's so big when it gets in your head, it pushes all the other thoughts out. And my obsession was a drink would improve this situation. It didn't matter a hoot what the situation was, a drink would improve this thing. And so I'd have the drink, and we'd go through the cycle again. And I could see that. That was true in my life. That was reality. The steps are really a road to reality. We think chemically we want to change reality, but what we really want to do is learn to live with reality. We never could change the bulldog. He had to get hold of something. But if we could have reached him, if we could have given him a different view of life where he could live comfortably without drinking, he would have been okay. And that's what happens to us. We change the way we see and react to life. And the first step is very, very important, that we recognize that we're powerless over the stuff. We can't use it. And the only choice we have at all is to leave it alone. And the other part is that our lives are unmanageable. We were trying to run things. We were trying to make the world work in our way. And that just doesn't work. If you think you can manage life, make a list of what's going to happen tomorrow. You ever done that? I have. I was a lawyer and I had a list of things. By God, tomorrow I'm going to do A, B, C, D, E, and F. And that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. Only I'd get one telephone call about A, between A and B, and the rest of it just go off the wall, and I'm doing X, Y, and Z down here. You can't manage life. Life comes to you in all different directions and all different kinds, and we We were people who insisted on it going a certain way and didn't even know we were doing that, really. But we were reacting as though we had to control it, and we couldn't control it, and we were unhappy with it. And we couldn't accept the fact that it was really beyond our ken to do that. So you get a real grounding in where you are and what you are when you take step one. We devote a lot of our book to that very thing, to break through the rationalization, the justification, all the other things that we use to hide the truth from ourselves. And we have to get through those things, and you have to get all your reservations. I never sponsored anybody in my life that I didn't, and I was sponsored this way. They told me to mark down anything in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't believe applied to me, that I disagreed with, because we're going to have to talk about any reservations I had, because if I had reservations, sooner or later, an event would come along and I would act out what I had the reservation against. So I had to break down my defense system so I could accept I am who I am. And that's the greatest freedom on earth, to be who you are, living inside your own values. Can't touch me with a 10-foot pole when I'm in that situation. What are you going to do to me now? What are you going to do to me now? So I began to do some other things. Now, I had a real problem with step two. Step two has some concepts in it that are difficult for me. It said, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Came to believe. I've been to a lot of churches. I had been to a lot of churches. I had talked to a lot of ministers. I had read books. I had been looking for God all my life. And the second day I was sober, I picked up the little 24-hour day book to see what those AA and A people were doing, because I was very quick and having a hell of a lot of problems going on, and I needed some help. And it said I was going to give my drinking problem to God this year. I can't tell you how disappointed I was in that statement. How are you going to give something to somebody you can't find? And I asked ministers, bright men and women, how do you get this thing? And they said, you have faith. You have faith. Did you ever try to have faith? I've sat in chairs and decided I'm going to have faith. Nothing happened. Same is true of belief. I can't give you my beliefs. I can tell you what my beliefs are. They may or may not resonate with your own life. But you're going to have your own beliefs. That's why we come to believe. I came to believe certain things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to believe them because I had experience, not because I had faith. Not because I came with faith. Some people may, and it's wonderful if you can, but I didn't. I was as nearly agnostic as you can get. And I came to believe certain things because I observed things happening in Alcoholics Anonymous, and things were happening to me which made me believe. I believe that, you know, faith without proof is gullibility. But I told them in the beginning, I don't believe all this stuff. And they said, we don't care. We don't care whether you believe it or not. We don't care whether you have faith or not. What we're going to do for you is we're going to tell you to take certain actions. And if you take them with honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, you will have your own personal experience. And you will believe. We don't know exactly what it'll look like. We don't know exactly what it'll be, but it'll be better than anything you've ever had in your life. So that started me on belief. I saw people in Alcoholics Anonymous get well that should not have been able to get well. They'd come in, you know, with a 4-day growth of beard on their face, dirty clothes, rusty zipper. You know why they got the rusty zipper. Somebody here knows. And you know this guy's not going to make it. He's just not going to make it. He hasn't got enough left. He can't make a complete sentence. He starts telling you about one thing and it drifts off and it's something else before he gets through with it. He's not going to make it. And he hangs around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, gets a shave, a new pair of pants, some clean clothes, takes a bath, and emerges from that horrible state that he came in as a decent, God-fearing human being. How'd that happen? How did that happen? Something here is working. I sat in rooms like this and got caught up in what was going on. And I felt something. There was a power working in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to do something with this God as I understand him. I had always defined God as, or thought of God as, a big man somewhere sitting on a cloud, wearing a long robe, had lightning bolts on one side, you know, and a scorecard right up here, and he kept score for me and pulled out a lightning bolt every once in a while and knocked me on my can because I wasn't doing the right thing. And I tried to avoid that. I didn't believe that. I did not believe that. I'd driven a tractor a lot of days out there as a kid in West Texas and looked up at the clouds and never saw him sitting on a cloud one day. Just couldn't. And I went to the preachers, told them, okay, what'd God stand on when he made the earth? They haven't got any questions. They haven't got any answers for questions like that, you know. And they'd tell me to have faith. And I had a trouble getting my head around God. Now, I have no problem whatsoever in understanding that there's something a lot bigger in this world than we are. I read a couple of articles one time, a long time ago. It says, talking about space, sun's 93 million miles from Earth. If this distance was the thickness of that paper, a stack of paper would be 71 feet high to the nearest star. And our galaxy would be 3 million. A stack of paper 3 million feet high. That's big. That's big there. The scientists talk about the Big Bang Theory. I got a question for the scientist. Who made the bang? Who made the material that sailed out and created the universe? Where'd it come from? There's something bigger than we are, a whole lot bigger than we are. But what I had real trouble with was that could have anything to do with me. I was so small, so insignificant, and lived such a short period of time on my life. You know, time, another factor about God and this universe and things is time. We manufacture time, but Michener in his book, the Centennial book, talks about the old Rockies. There were some ancient Rocky Mountains near the same place where the new ones are. And they were 10,000 feet high, according to the scientist. And they just wore away. And he says, how does that happen? And he said, each million years, they lost 250 feet, which meant that each 1,000 years, they lost 3 inches. Which meant each year you couldn't even measure the wear and tear on those mountains. So yeah, there's something bigger than I am. Yeah, there's a power greater than myself. But could it have anything to do with me? But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw it having to do with people. I saw people getting well. And so I defined God It's whatever works in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever kind of power there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I still think that. That's the most direct experience I've had with the power. I don't at all want to make light of anybody else's experience. I had no conversion experience in the sense that I went up to the front of the church and they asked me after I'd gone to the front of the church because I thought that was where it was going to happen. They asked me, "Jerry, don't you feel different?" And I said, "Yes, I did." I was more disappointed than ever because nothing had happened to me. Now, it happens to some people. It happens to some people. I really believe that. It just didn't happen to me because I was demanding. I had set up standards that God had to meet. It just doesn't work that way. It works only when we meet the standards the universe has set for us to meet. And that's where I missed the boat for so long. It wasn't in sprinkling and dunking and things that they did. I done it. All those things have been done to me more than once. Nothing ever happened until I got in a chair in the middle of a bunch of drunks and I saw some power working in their lives and felt it beginning to work in my own. And then I came to believe. And when you come to believe, then you look back at what all these other folks have been talking about all these years and you can say, yeah, that's right. They're right. Bill says in the book, you know, how many people in this world are helped by their religions. They go back to their religions. They're involved in their religions and they're happy in their religions. I've never fit in a religion very well because I'm kind of a mongrel. I just don't quite find the spot for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has been my spot. But it's not the only thing I've studied or read or done since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone back over those same books and to the same ministers, and I've talked to them. I've talked to ministers who said, you know, I've been to some of those Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. My gosh, if we could get that going on in our church, it would be something great. We could reach a lot of people. People really transform their lives in this. And the book talks about how we're reborn. I don't know how that word ever got left in the book with a bunch of agnostics and atheists like we have, but somebody let it slip through. The preachers talk about being reborn all the time. But we're changed at a depth, the foundations of our mind. If we really involve ourselves, if we do the things, you know, back on step one there, back on how it works. Did you ever go through that? We read that thing so many times. Y'all don't, you read an abbreviated version. But we read it so often in my part of the country that we kind of get immune to hearing it. We don't really think about what it's saying. Think about what they're asking us to do in there. It requires thoroughness. It requires honesty. It requires willingness to go to any length to get sober. It requires fearlessness. You know, you got to take a chance. What a chance are you taking? Not much of one. Because you can have your misery back any day you want it. But you've got to be willing to risk a new idea. There's no easier, softer way. We give up our old ideas. That's what a lot of our program is about, is to finding out what, first of all, you don't even know what they are. And then when you find them out, you hang on to them because you think they've worked, but they haven't. So you have to get a new frame of reference for this. It says half measures of basal snuffing. Now, that's a kicker right there. If you do half of this thing, you ought to get 50%, right? Not a deal. Zero. Half measures get you zero. So it requires a real deep dedication to find your bottom, to find where you are, who you are, and to take a good look at your spiritual life. And that's another thing. We talk about this being a spiritual program. What is spiritual? What is spiritual? Spiritual is never anything that you can see. Never anything you can see. It's love. It's kindness. It's goodness. And it can be always discovered, because the more you try, more you give away of it, the more you have of it. If, as opposed to material, I chased material things a long time. I was big on material stuff. But it has no lasting benefit to you. You just get it, and it's gone away. I remember when I first started practicing law, I had to ride the bus to work. I did not like to ride the bus to work. And I knew just as soon as I could afford two cars, everything was going to be all right. And I ultimately got enough money together to buy another car. And so I would take my car to work. You know, I hadn't had that second car a week until I came upon a great truth. Wrong kind of car. I needed a bigger car, a better car, a different kind of car. And then I got a bigger, better, different kind of car, and that one lasted about 2 weeks, and I saw another one that I really thought maybe I should have got. And so you chase more, better, and different till you can't chase them anymore, and you never get any fulfillment out of them. But you get fulfillment out of spiritual life. You feel good about yourself. You feel good about your fellow man. You feel good about life. You can always find something good going on. And that's what the spiritual life is all about for us. We need to engage in that spiritual conduct. We're headed toward a spiritual awakening. And these are just the first few steps that we take along the way. Well, we're going to stop here now and switch over to take a few minutes break, and we're going to switch over and do 3, 4, and 5. So I'll see you back here in about 20 minutes. Okay. Well, as we finish the 12th step, finish how it works, the part we usually read, it says we're convinced, A, that we're alcoholics, and B, that no human power can help us, and that God could and would if he were sought. And step 3 says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. This carries forward some of my reservations about God, as you can imagine. This sounded an awful lot like the altar call that I heard in a lot of churches. And it is the altar call that you hear often in churches, I believe. The churches didn't go much, as far as teachings, didn't go a lot beyond that. They left you to the Bible and your Sunday school classes and that sort of thing. And we're maybe a little more organized as to how you proceed, how you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, than perhaps they are. At least it worked that way for me. Remarkable things happen at step 3. There's a story about a little boy who had a tricycle. He'd ride his tricycle up and down the front of the house. He lived next door to the preacher. I haven't got anything against preachers, by the way. They just happened to be handy for me to tell my story. And he'd ride his bike up and down the street. One day he hit a little chug hole in the sidewalk. Threw him off his tricycle, bent the wheel of his tricycle, skinned his knees, and tore his pants. He got up and he looked at that wreck. And the preacher, he didn't see the preacher standing nearby, but he got up and he said, "Son of a bitch." The preacher stepped out from behind the bush and he said, no, my son. He said, "This is not the way we deal with adversity. When we encounter adversity, we say, praise God." The kid just looked at him and drug his old bent tricycle off. And he got the tricycle fixed and got a new pair of pants. His knee healed. And same kid, same preacher, same sidewalk, same tricycle. He's riding down there, lickety-split one day, and he hits the same chug hole, throws him off, bends the wheel of his tricycle, skins his knee, tears his pants. He gets up and takes a deep breath and he looks at the wreck and he said, Praise God. The wheel on that tricycle is straightened up. The pants were mended. And the knee was healed. And the preacher, having seen this happen, said, "Son of a bitch." Our book says that to take this step, the first requirement is to be convinced that a life based on self-centeredness can hardly be successful. Well, did you have any trouble with self-centeredness? I didn't. I started reading the big book after maybe a week in Alcoholics Anonymous, because people were always quoting it to me. And I'm not going to be quoted to unless I know what the source is really saying about things. So I read the thing just to be sure that they were giving me straight scoop. And they were. But when I hit that page over there that said, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, I skipped the rest of that page and went on to the next page. Why should I read about your problem? I am neither selfish nor self-centered, and there's no need for me to pay attention to this kind of nonsense. I give money to the church. I support a family. God knows I'm generous to a fault with my wife. I could not ever be considered selfish or self-centered. And so I had a little trouble with this concept. I didn't find self-centeredness quickly. I had to begin to see it in my own life as I heard it described in your lives, in meetings. I was sitting in a meeting one night. The funny thing about AA is you got all this wealth of experience. Your database is your life. All the things that have happened to you. You've never learned the lessons in a lot of those things. You just lived through them. Tried to discard them, did your best to forget them, and go on. And I was no different. And I was in a meeting one night, and I heard a guy describing, he was a wonderful friend of mine, but he got fired from almost every job he ever had within 2 weeks. He just could not keep his mouth shut. He'd get there and find out where the restroom was and what time lunch it was off, and then he'd start trying to run the place, and they'd run him off. And I was sitting there, and I was thinking about him, and I remember that's where I remembered the story about Patches about that old bulldog. Then a little later I remembered another thing that happened to me. I watched a lot of television while I was drinking. My solution to getting drunk and getting in trouble was to not go where I got drunk and got in trouble anymore. And when you drank as long as I did in Dallas, there was a lot of places you couldn't go. And I didn't want a DWI because I figured that would get me my law license lifted some way or other. And I have to explain that to those nice people that I worked with downtown who probably wouldn't understand. So I spent a lot of time at home, and I grew bored with television. Drunk, you're bored with television. One day I was in a pet shop. I don't know why I was in the pet shop, but I saw an aquarium, sort of like they have downtown here. I could give a demonstration of this whole talk right here downstairs at that aquarium, because I selected the size aquarium that I wanted. I put the aquarium between my chair and the wall. I put the kind of gravel, the colors that I wanted in the bottom of it. I put the kind of plants that I wanted in it. Leafy, graceful plants that sort of reached up to the surface. I filled it with water And I put the kind of fish in there that I wanted. And the kind of fish that I wanted were pretty, slow-swimming fish. I had a light on it. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. And I fed my fish. They were my fish. It was my aquarium. I fed my fish if they were to be fed. Sometimes it was a land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. It was an idyllic place. I could sit there and look at those fish glide around that water, and I just loved watching them. It was a perfect world. Well, almost. This one night I remembered there was always one fish. Usually a bowl cleaner or some necessary fish that you had in there, and he would swim up to one of the prettier fish and nip him on the tail, which would cause the prettier fish to begin to swim faster to get away from him. He, in turn, would encounter other fish. And the first thing you know, the whole damn bowl was just going fish everywhere. Just drove me crazy. And I'd slap the side of that tank. Let them know there's somebody, some power out there greater than they were that was not happy. I gave them three chances. Three claps of thunder. And I realized there were some fish that were unfortunate. They seemed to have been born that way. They needed a little hands-on experience with the power. So I bought me a little dip net. And I would catch the bad fish. And I'd take him out and put my hand on top of the dip net, hold him on my lap, and have a drink. When they get still, I would flip them back in the tank. If they float, you've kept them out too long. So I would give them three claps of thunder, three hands-on experiences with the power. Now, you know any self-respecting, intelligent fish would catch on after that kind of treatment. But there are still such unfortunates. They're hopeless, helpless, and the fourth time I put the dip net on them, I would just carry them carefully into the commode and flush them. Nobody in the world knew I was playing that game. My son, one night I was doing a 12-step call, and he was in the program. He invited me to come to a hospital. He's a doctor. And talked to a young woman who was having a lot of trouble with her kidneys and her liver, and he wanted her to cheer it up a little bit. And so I was talking to her, and I told her about my fish. And when I got to the part where I said I took them in and flushed them down the toilet, his deal was that he was going to be able to stand in the back of the room. He wasn't going to say a word while this was going on. But from the back of the room, I heard he said, "My God, I wondered where all those fish went." Well, this night I remembered my fish, and I remembered what I did with them in this little game I was playing. And it suddenly occurred to me, you know, I've been thinking that my life is not unmanageable. Hell, I can't even run a fishbowl. And interestingly, I wonder how many 41-year-old men get upset by what fish are doing in a fishbowl. That might be self-centeredness. And then it began to open up to me. And I began to discover self-centeredness everywhere I went. On the freeway. Do you have a lane of traffic on a freeway? I do. It's called my lane. What goes on in my lane is my business. We travel at my speed in my lane. And there are people who actually interfere with you in your lane. And somebody has to punish them. And conveniently, I can change lanes and the next lane becomes my lane right away. And and I speed up and I can run off the road because it's my lane. Or if I go to a stop sign and I'm in the right lane or want to turn right and some fool's in front of me who just sits there, doesn't go, doesn't turn right, what he could, and then just drives. Why wasn't he in the left lane so that I could turn right where I wanted to turn? And I took things very seriously. I didn't realize how many hours a day I spent in my head with this self-centered concept. It's incredible. Self-centeredness, I believe. My wife one time said this. It was her original thought, and it may be right. She said, I believe that insanity is total self-centeredness. We're born, and we get started in life looking for things. We want food, and we have to announce that. We're taking care of ourselves as infants, and we have certain dual urges. I heard an old man call them one time, a spiritual teacher. He said, we want to have pleasure and avoid pain. We want to have acceptance and avoid rejection. We want to be important, and we want to not be ignored at all. And you think about that, and what we did when we had all those things going on for us, or trying to get to those deals, trying to get one thing and avoid the other, is we get totally wrapped up in ourselves. And the first thing we did as little babies, we cried. And that got people to come to us and take care of us. So we kept crying until people got tired of us crying and they started leaving us alone. Then we discovered something else. We'd be cute. We'd gurgle and coo, and they'd pick us up and do what we wanted us to do. But now we're gurgling and cooing when we don't really feel like it. So we've got an internal conflict. It's like coming up on a street sign. It says one way. It's got an arrow pointing way. Which way are we going to go? One way. So we're caught with this internal struggle. And we're trying to please people. At the same time, get what we want. And we try to do what other people want us to do. And that gets us some good for a while, but we're doing a lot of things we don't want to do. We try to follow the rules, but we don't always like to follow the rules. So we're constantly struggling with this internal focus that we have. We have this strange mind or strange phenomenon in our mind that we have an observer. If you really think about it, it knows what we're doing. It can look and see why and what we're doing. And this observer is a bigger mind than the little mind that is demanding what it wants. We focus on things. You know, you and I could walk out and go down the street, and at the end of the street we'd say, somebody would say, what was the most attractive thing you saw on the street? You'd see one thing and I'd see another. We focus, we have a screen in our minds. The things that we don't think are important just pass right on through. We don't even notice them. But we pick up everything that we think is important. And when we're self-centered, we pick up everything that affects us, that can impact me in any way. And we try to control or force that to happen. So we are trying to control our lives with our will. Bill, there's a solution. The paper he wrote before the big book, and included in the big book, says that our common sense becomes uncommonly good sense when we focus it in the right direction. But we're focused on this trying to take care of me and what I need and what I want and where I'm going to go and what's going to happen to me. And who did that? You know, you can walk into the room and if I don't know you or know you very little and you not speak to me, and I'm not offended by that. But let somebody come in that I like and admire that doesn't speak to me and I think, well, what's wrong with that son of a bitch? You know, what did I do to him? And I begin to internalize what's going on there. And I live my life that way, reacting with knee-jerk reactions to all kinds of stimuli that's going on around me. And I don't ever seem to catch on at all that I am self-centered. That's what self-centered is. The focus on things that have to do with self. Self-involvement. Self-centeredness. Self-criticism. We can't live in that arena with any kind of comfort. I can't. And the book says you can't either. When you say your will, what is your will? That you want to. You're here this morning because, unless the judge sent you, you want to be here. And if you're here because the judge sent you, you're here because you don't want to go to jail where he's going to send you if he don't come here. We're acting on our will. And we need to learn to devote our will to the right goals. And Bill in the book says that we devote our will to God's will. That's the proper use of the wills to try to determine what God would have us be. God would want us to be. Our lives, what are our lives? Well, our lives are what's going on around us. That's that thing you can't control. That's the bad fish nipping you on the tail. That's the guy dipping you out of the water at the dip net. That's all of those things are what's going on in life, and you can't control them at all. But we react as though they can be controlled. We make demands on ourselves and on others that are impossible to be achieved. So what we're trying to do in step 3 is get into the world of reality. We want to focus our minds on that which is positive for us. The early AAs had the four absolutes. Absolute unselfishness, honesty, purity, and love. Bill didn't include them in the book because he said he thought drunks would go crazy trying to be absolute anything. And he's probably right. But there's a great old man named, he's deceased now, a wonderful OA named Paul Keebler from St. Louis, Missouri. And Paul was a big talker about the four absolutes. And I said, well, what about Bill? Didn't Bill think that was just a little too strenuous for us alcoholics? And he said, oh, Christ. He said, that ain't got anything to do with it. He said, those are just goals.